Hello all. Thank you very much for coming on this first day of DragonCon. I was telling Scott earlier that as crowded as it is today, I'm kind of terrified of what it's going to be like tomorrow. But at least I hear registration is going really well, especially compared to last year. The lines were moving along, so big round of applause for the con staff on that. Okay, so how many people here have heard me speak about the Templars before? Just curious. A couple repeats. Okay. So my name's Ilanka, and my day job is I write computer games. I also am a cryptographer, and I write books about codes. And I helped an author named Dan Brown with the research for his book, The Lost Symbol. I also got to talking with him when he was writing The Da Vinci Code. Actually, in The Lost Symbol, he actually named a character after me. So if you've read The Lost Symbol, and there's a character named Nola Kay, and it's scrambled, it means Ilanka. He does that. So like his editor's name is Jason Kaufman, and in the book there's an editor named Jonas Falkman. So it just kind of, the letters moved around. So because of my association with Dan Brown, I got very interested in the fact and fiction of the Da Vinci Code, especially about the Templars. And another of my hobbies is that I write articles on Wikipedia. I'm an administrator on Wikipedia. And the Templar article at that time was not particularly good on Wikipedia, so I chose to expand it and get it up to what's called featured status. And I arranged for it to be on the front page of Wikipedia on a very special date, which was October 13th, 2007, which was the 700-year anniversary of October 13th, 1307, which was the day of the famous arrests of the Templars in France. So I'm going to be talking about what's real and accurate about the Templars, and I'm also going to be talking about some of the legends and also how some of those legends got started. So you've probably heard about things, especially with the... How many people here have read the Da Vinci Code? Okay, most of what you've read in the Da Vinci Code is not accurate. I'm just going to tell you that up front. But I will be talking about some of it. So you've probably heard of things like Roslyn Chapel, Holy Grail, this Baphomet image where the Templars devil worshippers. No, they weren't. And the Shroud of Turin, which actually does have a very faint association with the Templars, and I'll be talking about that. Also, if you ever happen to go to Versailles in France and at the Hall of Crusades, there's this massive painting showing this battle. Jacques Molay takes Jerusalem 1299. In actuality, there was no such battle. Jacques Molay was nowhere near the area. And I'll talk about how this painting made its way or you know, kind of showed up in Versailles and how that story got started as well. There's been many, many fictional treatments about the Templars. One that really got things going was the book Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott. Umberto Eco, more recently, wrote a book called Foucault's Pendulum, which refers to the Templars quite a bit. And, of course, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code and the sequel, The Lost Symbol. That's the one where Nola Kay appears in The Lost Symbol. And there's also computer games that talk about the Templars quite a bit. So Assassin's Creed, a wonderful series of games, loosely based on history. They you know, they have Templars. Yes, there were Templars. The Templars in Assassin's Creed are sort of more like the Templars that were in Ivanhoe, sort of this corrupt, evil organization, not really based on the reality of the Templars. And the whole thing about the pieces of Eden and all that's complete fiction. So in Da Vinci Code, at the beginning of the book, just to make things a little more confusing, it says, there's a page, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. No. And I've tried to put this in my slides, kind of a subtle thing. If you see something and you're not sure if you're looking at the legend or you're looking at the reality, if it's in italics, it means it's not real. And if it's in non-italics, that means it's probably accurate. I've tried to keep that consistent through my slides. So Da Vinci Code, a novel, came out in 2003 and was based quite a bit on a pseudo-history book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which came out in 1982. And the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which were Bagent Lee and Henry Lincoln, they tried pretty hard to do research and pull a lot of theories together, but they were really kind of speculating on what they were doing. And some of their research, they ran into things that they thought were true, but were actually documents that were created for fraudulent purposes, and the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail took those documents at face value. So like they saw some medieval documents, thought these documents were accurate, but the documents were actually forgeries. And I'll be talking a little bit about that. And also the authors were they were very imaginative people, and so if they had sort of a fact here and a fact here and a fact here, and they couldn't find a connection between those three, they kind of made it up, and then they put that into the book as well. And they came up with a very compelling idea, this idea that Jesus Christ had hooked up with Mary Magdalene, and that there was a child that had come from this union, and that the bloodline of this child was being protected by this group called the Priory of Sion. And in the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, they said they had a list of what do we know is true and what is not true. And one of the facts we know is the Priory of Sion is a real organization that was founded in 1099 and had a series of grand masters, including Leonardo da Vinci. Well, that is not a fact, but I'm going to talk a little bit about why they thought it was a fact. So you just see there's layers upon layers upon layers here. So according to the Da Vinci Code, what did Da Vinci Code say about Priory of Sion? It said it was a group founded in 1099, had a series of grand masters over the years, and that the Priory of Sion had founded the Order of the Knights Templar as their military arm. And that supposedly that there were documents that were verifying the Priory of Sion that had been found in a French church in a little village in the south of France called Rennes-le-Château. And supposedly these documents had been found in the late 1800s by a priest named Berger Saunière. Berger Saunière was real. There really was a priest named Berger Saunière. He really was in a town called Rennes-le-Château in southern France. He did not find any medieval documents. So the reality of the Knights Templar, they really did exist for about 200 years. They were part of the Crusades. Ballpark, they were around from about 1119 to 1312, and they were just everywhere in Europe. They were involved in all aspects of European society. They were involved in banking. They owned vineyards. They had a fleet of ships. They did protective services. They were guarding pilgrims who were going around. They were really the world's first multinational corporation. And they also had a number of building projects. So this is showing the Eastern Mediterranean here. So the area of modern-day Israel is here and Jerusalem. And we have Tripoli and Antioch, and the island of Cyprus is over here. So as part of the First Crusade, Jerusalem was conquered. However, though the city was under control, the area around Jerusalem was really not under control. There were bandits all over the place. But after Jerusalem was conquered, all these European pilgrims were saying, cool, it's under our control now. We want to go, and we want to sightsee and be tourists, and we want to go see all the holy places. So they would get on ships, and they would come down here to the nearest, I mean, Jerusalem's an inland city, it doesn't have a port. So the nearest port is this area called Jaffa. And the pilgrims would get to Jaffa, and then they'd start the overland trek to Jerusalem, and they would just get descended upon by bandits. And sometimes these pilgrims were being slaughtered, sometimes hundreds at a time. It was a really, really dangerous journey. So there was a veteran of the First Crusade named Hugh de Payon from northeastern France, and he came up with an idea. He said, how about if we found a monastic order to protect these pilgrims that are going from Jaffa to Jerusalem? And he pitched the idea to the first king of Jerusalem and said, can I found this monastic order? And they said, sure, go ahead. And so Hugh de Payon got together with Godfrey of St. Omer and a bunch of his other relatives, all from the same area of northeastern France, and they formed this order, this monastic order of monks who were also going to be carrying weapons. And this was a very radical idea at the time, this idea of a warrior monk, a man of the cloth, a holy man who's also carrying weapons. And so there were people who weren't entirely on board with this idea. But the king of Jerusalem at the time said, okay, cool. And he had set up his palace in an area called the Temple Mount. Temple Mount, very famous piece of real estate in Jerusalem. When the Crusaders came in, this building was already there. It's called the Dome of the Rock. It had been built about 300 years earlier by the Muslims when they'd conquered the area. And I'll talk about why it's called the Dome of the Rock. But when the Crusaders arrived, they didn't destroy it or anything. They just said, beautiful building, we're going to turn it into a church. And so they consecrated it, they put a cross on the top. And they began calling it the Temple of Solomon because they believed that this was the area where King Solomon's temple had been. Solomon, the son of David from about 1,000 years B.C. And there had indeed been the Temple of Solomon here. So this whole area is called the Temple Mount, the building with the gold roof, that's the Dome of the Rock. And also there's a building here which was also turned into a building for Crusader purposes but had been built earlier by the Muslims, and it was called Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa Mosque means the farthest mosque, and I'll talk a bit about that. It's not entirely sure. There's a lot of dispute about where exactly Solomon's Temple was on this area. Some people say it might have been in here in the middle. Some people say it might have been over here where the Gold Dome was. If you've heard about the Jewish Wailing Wall or the Western Wall, that's down here. So if you ever see those pictures of people going to a wall and praying towards a wall, because many Jews believe that not only that Solomon's Temple was here, but that the Holy of Holies was there, which was the divine presence. And since they don't know exactly where it was up on the Temple Mount, they choose not to accidentally walk on that area, and so they stay down here and they pray towards the wall instead, as showing respect. So it's the Temple Mount is the holiest site in three religions. Holy site in Judaism, holy site in Christianity. It's believed that that's where God collected the dust to create Adam, where Abraham was going to sacrifice his son was up there. If you've heard about Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple, that's where the temple was. All of these things took place there. And it was also where the Ark of the Covenant was stored, the Holy of Holies in the Solomon's Temple. And the whole area is referred to several times in the Old and New Testament. Now, in Islam, the Temple Mount is the third holiest site in Islam, and it's believed that Muhammad traveled there. And this is something that it's a very important, incredibly important story in Islam, but there's debate about did it really happen, or was it a dream, or is it an allegory of some sort? And what it is, the Isra and Miraj, was that in 621, Muhammad, who was living in Mecca at the time, he was born in Mecca, that he was sleeping, and then he was awoken, and he was carried by this sort of a Pegasus-like creature. It was called the Burak. It was a winged animal. It was called the lightning steed. And Muhammad was taken by the steed to the farthest mosque. Didn't say exactly where, they just said the farthest mosque. And that there he dismounted and he prayed and he was on this great stone, and then he mounted the Burak again and he was taken up into heaven. And there he met many of the prophets, he met Moses, he met others, and he was taken through the various circles of heaven up to meet Allah, God. And God greeted him and gave Muhammad instructions to take back down to earth, such as things like that everyone should pray to him 50 times a day and various other things. So Muhammad is and he leaves, and as he's descending, and he runs into the prophets, and I believe it's Moses says, "Hey, Muhammad, come here." Moses said, "Well, what did God tell you?" And Muhammad answers, "Well, we're supposed to pray 50 times a day, and I'm supposed to tell everyone." And Moses said, "They won't do it. Go back and ask for a reduction." So this is the story. So Muhammad goes back up to God and says, "You know, can we make it fewer times than 50 times a day?" And this goes back and goes back and he goes back at reduction. Finally, it's reduced from 50 times a day to 5 times a day. That all Muslims are required to pray 5 times a day. Like, okay, they can do that. And so then he comes back through the Burak, comes back, and then is taken back to Mecca, where he communicates all of these commandments from God. So this place where supposedly he was taken from this area called the farthest mosque to heaven was on the Temple Mount. There was this rock, supposedly, that Muhammad stood upon that rock. And that's why we have the Dome of the Rock. It's built over the place where the Muslims believe that Muhammad was. Now, there's no historical proof that Muhammad was actually in Jerusalem ever. And the whole idea of this, was he there? Did he go up? And the whole idea of the farthest mosque, at the time he was there, there was no mosque. There was no Dome of the Rock. There was no Al-Aqsa Mosque. And there's even debate among Muslim scholars today as where was this the farthest mosque. But a couple decades later, when the Muslims did take over Jerusalem, they went to that spot and they said, okay, here's where Muhammad must have been. And they built a mosque, and they called that mosque the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the farthest mosque. So this is all happening about the year 700 or so. So there's confusion today. People will go and they say, this mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the farthest mosque, this must be the mosque that Muhammad visited. But no, that mosque was built after Muhammad actually maybe visited the area. So again, so both of these structures were built after Muhammad would probably have visited the area. But anyway, getting back to the Templars believed that the Temple of Solomon was here, and so that's why they took their order. They were the Knights of the Temple. That's why they're called Templars. And they were allowed to stay here, so the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which they used for stables for their horses, and this was really the center of operation of the Templars. So that's Al-Aqsa Mosque there. All right. Now, again, going back to the idea of this warrior monk thing, a lot of controversy about that, but they had some very powerful supporters who would speak very eloquently on their behalf. And one of them was a man who was eventually canonized, St. Bernard de Clairvaux. And he would say things like, "A Templar knight is truly a fearless knight and secure on every side, for his soul is protected by the armor of faith, just as his body is protected by the armor of steel. He is thus doubly armed and need fear neither demons nor men." And he was so persuasive about this that when the church leaders got together to debate about should the Templars be allowed to exist or not, they decided yes, they should be allowed to exist, and they authorized them as a church officially, you know, stamped by the church authorized charity. So now everyone in Europe that wanted to help out with the Crusades are wondering, you know, can we donate money? Well, it was to the Templars, because they were one of the main charities. Donate to the Templars and you're helping the cause in the Holy Land. So the Templars became a very, very well-funded monastic organization very suddenly. They were given money. They were given land. They were given noble-born sons to join the order. And so they became very well-financed, well-trained military units that would help out in many of the battles of the Crusades. It was very well organized. St. Bernard set up a set of rules about exactly how they were to live. There were different strata in the Templars. There were the knights who had white robes with a red cross, and then there were sergeants who had a brown robe. The knights had to wear their robe at all times. I mean, they weren't allowed to eat unless they were wearing their robe. They were not allowed to have any contact with women at all, even members of their own family. Once you were a Templar, you were not even to touch a woman of any kind. The Templars also, as they were going back and forth from Europe to the Holy Land, the Pope gave them amazing authority. They could pass freely through all borders. They didn't have to pay any taxes. They were subject to no one except to the Pope. So they had just enormous power in the area. Here's a picture of a Templar. And they were some serious warriors. And as long as their flag was flying, they were not to leave the battlefield. Didn't matter if they were losing. If the flag was up, they had to stay on the battlefield. If their flag went down, they were required to look to see if one of the other military orders, like the Knights of the Hospital, or Knights of Malta, if one of their flags was up, then the Templars were supposed to rally to those flags as well. Not until all flags had fallen were the Templars allowed to leave. And the Muslims actually had great respect for the Templars, because Templars were serious warriors. They weren't messing around. So there were different Grand Masters in the different countries, and there was a Grand Master over the entire order. This was a lifetime appointment, though sometimes that could be really short, because the Grand Masters were often warriors themselves. So someone could become a Grand Master, and then there would be a battle, they'd die in battle, and then a new Grand Master would be appointed. But they had, in the different countries, they had centers. So one of the centers was in England, this was in London, the Temple Church. And these churches tended to be built in round structures based on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that was in Jerusalem. And they had a very tightly knit, they had an initiation ceremony, and these initiation ceremonies were secret. And this is one of the things that later on started causing trouble, because people would wonder what's going on at these ceremonies. But at the ceremonies they had to take vows, chastity, piety, poverty, obedience. And if you go to London and you see anything related to temple, it's probably related to the Templars at the time, where the initiation ceremonies took place. If you see the temple tube station, all of this is related to the Templars. They also came up basically with the first idea of international banking. So they were, their original mission, remember, was to guard these pilgrims that were traveling from Europe to Jerusalem. And rather than requiring the pilgrims to carry money, which made them more attractive targets for thieves, the Templars would say, okay, deposit your money here in London or Paris or wherever you are with us. We'll give you a letter. You take this letter with you to Jerusalem, and then you give it to the Templars in Jerusalem. They'll give you your money, and on you go. So it just kind of increased their financial power across the continent as they were really becoming the first international banking organization. They would also guard valuables. If someone wanted to save for their retirement or save valuables or something to give them more security, where do you put it? Well, the Templars will guard it for you. So the Templars became known as the guardians of stuff, your wealth, or pilgrims, or anything that needed to be guarded, the Templars were probably guarding it. And then this will tie into the legends as well. So many battles, I won't go into all the details, but if you've heard of the Muslim leader Saladin, very well-respected man, he kind of got the Muslims more organized and battled with the Crusaders and was able to push the Crusaders out of Jerusalem. They lost Jerusalem. The Crusaders were kicked out of Jerusalem in 1187, and then from Jerusalem, and then they relocated to the coastal city of Acre, which they held for about another 100 years, and then they got pushed out of that, and they got pushed back to Cyprus. They made one last effort in the early 1300s to try and retake Tortosa. They were trying to form an alliance with the Mongols at the time, because the Mongol Empire was coming in, and they were thinking, like, well, maybe the Europeans can bond with the Mongols, and then, you know, the Mongols want to kick out the Muslims, and it never came together, but it was one last-ditch effort, but that didn't work, and that was pretty much it. So early 1300s, the Templars, who had been formed to protect pilgrims and help out with the Crusades, but now the Crusades are pretty much over. The Crusaders are no longer on the continent, and there's questions about why do we still have these military orders when we don't really need them. Now, King Philip IV of France, who was not a nice guy, was also deeply in debt to the Templars, because the nobles would go to the Templars and say, we need money for this or whatnot, and the Templars would loan the money. So Philip was deeply in debt to the Templars, and he was thinking, okay, well, one way to avoid paying them back, get rid of them, just disband the order. Not quite that simple, but that was the basic idea. Philip was also constantly in conflict with the papacy at the time. An earlier Pope Boniface VIII, there'd been a battle between him and King Philip, because King Philip was saying king above pope, and Pope Boniface was saying, no, pope above king. So Philip had Boniface kidnapped and charged with heresy, spitting on the cross, urinating on the cross, Satan worship. It was absurd. He was charging the pope with heresy. Boniface was an elderly guy. Eventually, his townspeople rose up and they rescued Boniface, but he was in shock from the whole thing, and he died about a month later. So cardinals go into conclave. They choose a new pope. That pope, also in conflict with Philip, and gets poisoned by Philip's agents. So cardinals go into conclave again. You know, what are we going to do now? Who wants to be pope? So they were in conclave for a year debating this. Finally, they decided on someone, a Frenchman, who had been a childhood friend of Philip's. And this Frenchman was Pope Clement V. And he became pope, and he moved the papacy from Italy to France. So if you ever heard of something like the Avignon papacy or the Avignon captivity, this is that. The papacy was now out of Italy, in France. It's really very much under Philip's thumb. And Philip is saying, okay, disband the Templars. And Pope Clement is, he's subject to Philip, but he's still not really crazy about doing this, so there's still a little bit of conflict. So Philip takes matters into his own hands, and there's previous Templars that have been kicked out for whatever reason. They weren't following the rules, or there were disgruntled ex-employees, let's talk about it that way. And so they had certain complaints about the Templars. And Philip used these to build a series of charges, and he decided that he was going to have these Templars arrested. And it was a very dramatic thing that in France, the morning of October 13th, 1307, all across France, all Templars were to be arrested. And it took place, and it was a dramatic dawn raid. Philip wanted to arrest the Templars and to capture all of their assets. It didn't happen across Europe. This was just in France. But it happened, and then these Templars that were captured were then tortured, and they were charged with heresy, spitting on the cross, urinating on the cross, the exact same charges that Philip had early used against that inconvenient pope who had not been agreeing with him. So the Templars were tortured. They'd confess to anything under torture. And the pope said, hang on, let's have proper trials for these Templars. And Philip said, nope, they've already confessed, burn them. And had many of them burned at the stake. Very messy business. So Pope Clement, who was continuing to be pressured by Philip, who was now starting to get military forces that were starting to surround where the pope was, the pope issued an order on November 26, 1307, so this is about a month later, saying, okay, arrest all Templars in Europe, seize their assets. So it was very dramatic, and many of the other European nobles weren't quite sure what to do. They knew that this was trumped up stuff from Philip, but here they had an order from the Pope. So what were they going to do? And so different areas kind of handled things in different ways. For example, all of the Templars in Portugal, they said, okay, well, all right, the order is to arrest all Templars. We're no longer Templars. We are now the Order of Christ. And that's what they did. They just changed their name. They had the same structure, the same building, same everything. Some of the areas where there were Templars, they had trials. No one was convicted at all, but they had to go through all this process of dealing with it. And meanwhile, there were other Templars in France, and they were trying to defend themselves, and Philip, again, just burn them, and had more of them burned at the stake. So Pope Clement, eventually, he issued an order saying, just disband the Templars, we're done. And then he issued another order, which is saying, anything the Templars own now belongs to this other military order, the Knights Hospital, Knights Hospitalet. So one of the big stories about the Templar, who was the Grand Master at the time that all of this was going on? It was Jacques de Molay. And Jacques de Molay happened to be in Paris when all this went down, and he was one of the guys that got arrested and was tortured into admitting all kinds of things. And then he recanted, saying, no, I didn't do those things. And then he'd be tortured again. He'd say he did that, and he was going back and forth. And for years, this went on. And finally, he's an older guy, 7 years have been going on. Finally, he just said, it didn't happen, and he refused to admit that anything had happened. And so Philip said, burn him. And it was a very dramatic event. It was on the River Seine in the middle of Paris, where Jacques de Molay and one of his associates, Geoffrey de Charnay, both of them were burned at the stake in a very dramatic public execution. According to legend, they were near the Notre Dame Cathedral, and according to legend, Jacques de Molay asked to be tied to the stake in such a way where his hands were together and he was facing the Notre Dame Cathedral. And according to legend, he called out from the flames that both Pope Clement and King Philip would soon meet him before God. Well, of the other Templars, some were tried, virtually none were convicted. Many of them just retired. They were pensioned off. Some of them moved off. They, instead of being Templars, they joined the Knights Hospital or something. And as I mentioned, in Portugal, they just changed their names. So, and this is in Portugal. This is one of the, again, you can see the round building, and it's now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So, sure enough, within a year after Jacques de Molay was executed, Pope Clement died, and King Philip, who was a relatively young guy, also died. One of them of, I believe, illness, and the other one died in a hunting accident. And then King Philip's sons died, and within a few years, his entire line was gone. And it was very dramatic, the kind of thing that sparks legends and ideas and what happened. There's actually a series of books that were written in the 1950s called Les Rois Maudits, The Accursed Kings, and a whole French miniseries that was done on this. And I'd love to get a copy of that, all with English subtitles. It's supposed to be done with very high production values. So that was the Templars. All right, so some of the rumors that have come up, well, they were all arrested on this day, October 13th. Was that the origin of the Friday the 13th legend? No. Friday the 13th really started becoming used in the early 1900s. Now, how can we prove that Friday the 13th did not come from the Templars? Well, you can get books on folklore and superstition and mythology from the 1800s, from the 1700s, and look up. What is thing? Is Friday considered an unlucky day? Yeah. Is 13 considered an unlucky number? Yeah. Is there a Friday the 13th? Nothing. Yeah. These things weren't really put together until the early 1900s, probably because, and there's speculation about where it came from, but my theory, or from what I've read, is that there was a politician who did something stupid, as politicians do, on the 13th, which happened to be a Friday. And then the next day, the newspapers were making fun of him, as newspapers will do about politicians. They were saying, doing something on a Friday the 13th, how stupid can you be? And so this idea of the Friday the 13th, it became a meme, and it became an idea that kind of persisted from there. This is another thing that's associated with the Templars, this idea of Baphomet, and were they Satan worshippers, as Philip was claiming they were. And I get really irritated at some History Channel and National Geographic documentaries because they'll do reenactments of Templars, and they'll show Templars standing in a room all around this figure of Baphomet as though it really happened. And this image was not drawn until the 1800s, 500 years after the Templars were disbanded. And it's fiction. It's totally made up. And so any documentary that's saying, oh, and here the Templars were standing around this image, it's absurd and irresponsible. Now, this image was named Baphomet, and the name Baphomet did appear in the transcripts from when these Templars were being tortured in the 1300s. But what did Baphomet mean? Did that mean that it meant a satanic image? No, it was probably a misspelling of Muhammad, because the Templars were in the Crusades, they were dealing with Muslims, and so Muhammad, you probably see Muslim, is it Muslim or Moslem, and there's all these different misspellings of it. That was probably what it meant. If you read legitimate works of history by legitimate historians, most of them agree that Baphomet was just a misspelling of Muhammad. Right. Holy Grail and the Templars. How did this get connected? Holy Grail was basically medieval fan fiction. Okay, it was a story that was created in 1180. It was written by a man named Chrétien de Troyes, who was from that same area of northeastern France, which is from where Hugh de Payon and the other original Templars were from. And in this story, Le Conte du Graal, the story of the Grail, there's one part of the story which is talking about Parzival is seeing something very mysterious in a room. And that mysterious item, just like we can watch a TV series or a movie and there's something like, what's that? And we want to know more about it. And that sparked imagination of people. And they started writing more stories about what that thing was. And the original Conte du Graal, I have the French and the English, and I'll read them both to you. So this was the first place that it really appeared was, une demoiselle très belle, et élancée et bien parée qui avec les valets venait, tenait un Graal entre ses mains. Quand on la salle, elle fut entrée avec le Graal qu'elle tenait. Une si grande lumière en vint que les chandelles ont pu dire leur clarté comme les étoiles quand se lève soleil ou lune. Okay, English. A beautiful girl, slender and well-dressed, came in with the servants, holding a Grail in her hands. As she entered the room with the Grail, which she held, such a great light came that the candles lost their brilliance, as do stars upon the rising of the moon or the sun. So it's like, what's that? What's that? What's that? It's nothing about Jesus, nothing about the Last Supper, just this Grail. Is it a cup? Is it a plate? Is what's going on? And so people started building stories upon that. What is it? And they would start conflating it with other stories. Well, is it something to do with food? Well, there's these stories about cornucopias, you know, with endless food coming from them. Maybe it's something like that. Or maybe it's a holy cup. Or maybe it had something to do with Jesus. You know, and people just started putting together until they found stories that would just kind of perpetuate. And eventually this idea of a Grail, it's a special cup and it had to do with Jesus. And then it was like, well, maybe it held blood in it. And it just kept going on and on and on from there. And then also, if there was a Grail, if people were thinking, what is a Grail? Where is it? Well, the Templars are probably guarding it, because that's what Templars do, is they guard cool stuff. And there was also a story called Parzival, where there was something called the Grail Kingdom, and the Templars were guarding the Grail Kingdom. That's what they did, is they guarded things. So going on to another legend, Rosalind Chapel, what's the association with Templars? Well, it was built in the mid-1400s. So again, the Templars were disbanded in the early 1300s. And this family that built the chapel, they may have had some association, sort of like if today, if you're related to a saint or someone who's in the Revolutionary War or something, you can say, and if you have a tomb or something, you'll have images that are related to the things that you're proud of in your own family history. So Rosalind Chapel, they built these things, and there were some Templar symbols that were built in this chapel, like two riders on a single horse, which was from the original Templar seal. And there was also some Masonic imagery, having to do with the stonemason guilds. So now we go on to another thing, which is Freemasons. Is anyone here a Freemason? So you probably think, do you know if York Rite or Scottish Rite or any idea? Okay. So if I say anything that's wrong, you guys feel free to speak up. But Freemasonry, there's many people that are Masons today, but it really kind of emerged in the early 1700s. And as they were building rituals about Freemasonry, and they started incorporating symbols from earlier parts of history and the Templars, so 400 years earlier, still very vivid in the imagination. So the Freemasons started incorporating some Templar rituals into their own in the early 1700s. And then stories started building on top of that. And well, maybe there was an unbroken line from the 1700s to the late 1300s. And people start forgetting about this 400-year gap that's going on. Okay. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a sec. So then there's the Shroud of Turin, which supposedly this was the burial shroud of Jesus Christ. It was first displayed in 1357. So this is after the disbanding of the Templars. And who owned it? Well, it was owned by the family of Geoffrey de Charnay, who was that other guy who was burned along with Jacques de Molay in the island, in the Seine River on the island in the middle of Paris. So it may have belonged to the Templars. The Templars did collect relics, and in Catholicism, it's people will try to collect relics, the finger of someone who was a saint or the skull of someone. And if they ran into this and thought that it was a holy relic, then yeah, the temple would have guarded it. And so that's the connection there between the Turin and the Templars. So let me see how I'm doing on time here. Okay, so let me talk a little more about the Priory of Sion, the real Priory of Sion. Nothing to do with the Crusades. This was a hoax that was created in the 1950s by a man named Pierre Plantard. Pierre Plantard was a Frenchman who believed that all the world's ills would be fixed if he were declared king. So he figured he had to be king of France and then he could fix things. And he decided that to become king, he would commit fraud. So, like most kings, right? So he had a few people helping him, and he created this organization called the Priory of Sion, which he claimed was an old medieval organization. And there were medieval documents which showed a bloodline of kings from the Merovingians, so I'll talk a little bit more about the Merovingians in a sec, that showed this bloodline going to modern day, and that Pierre Plantard was the rightful heir to this line of French kings, and therefore he should be declared king. So what do you do if you have forged documents, medieval documents, that you want to put out so that people discover them? You can't just say, oh, look what I found, because then it immediately comes back to you. So it was actually pretty clever. He planted these these forged documents in two different places in France. In one case, he planted them in their national library, in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And some other documents, he planted in a book that was about Rennes-le-Château, this little town in southern France, where there had been a priest named Berger Saunière in the late 1800s. And this part is real. Berger Saunière came into a lot of money, mysteriously. And suddenly he had a lot of money, and he was funding all these building projects in Rennes-le-Château. This is true. And the townspeople, this is a tiny little village, and they're wondering, where did he get this money? What did he do? And we fast forward about 50 years, and there's a man named Noel Corbeau. Noel Corbeau goes to Rennes-le-Château. He has a restaurant. But Rennes-le-Château is this tiny little village way off in the middle of nowhere. He's not getting enough business. So what do you do if you have a restaurant or a hotel and you want to get business? You make up a story, either about a ghost story in the area, or you make up a story about a buried treasure somewhere in the area. So Corbeau had heard these stories about the priest Berger Saunière, and so Corbeau starts, you know, pitching these stories. Did you know that there was a priest who had a big treasure, and maybe there's a treasure buried somewhere in Rennes-le-Château? Come to Rennes-le-Château and look for this treasure. And by the way, you can stay at my inn and eat at my restaurant. And this idea of this millionaire priest really kind of caught on. And so tourists start going to Rennes-le-Château. And this guy, Gérard de Sède, who was an associate of Pierre Plantard, the guy who wanted to be king, they wrote a book called Le Trésor Maudit de Rennes-le-Château, the accursed treasure of Rennes-le-Château. And in this book, they talked about how Berger Saunière, in the 1800s, while renovating his church, had opened a pillar, and in the pillar, he'd found these medieval documents. And look, here are the medieval documents being reproduced in the book. Berger Saunière never found any medieval documents. He never found anything. Yes, he funded building projects. Yes, he had money. But then the story kind of keeps building from there. Well, where did Saunière's money come from? Well, maybe these documents that he found had to do with a big secret in the church, and Saunière was protecting the secret, and the church was paying him off so that Saunière wouldn't tell the secret, and maybe Jesus Christ was buried there, or, you know, just stories start building up on that. So Rennes-le-Château really became sort of like the Roswell of France. If there's something weird, something to do with UFOs, any kind of weird supernatural things, it's like Scotland has Loch Ness and France has Rennes-le-Château. So, told you about all those things. Noel Corbeau, told you about that, told you about Plantard. So in the 1960s, a guy named Henry Lincoln, who'd written for Doctor Who, all right, he's an English guy, he's a screenwriter, he goes down here, you know, to Rennes le Château, and he picks up this book, Le Trésor Maudit, and he's reading it, and he finds these medieval documents, and he finds a secret code that's hidden in the medieval documents, and he goes, I found a code. And he goes back to BBC, and he says, hey, I found some cool stuff about Rennes le Château. I want to do a series of documentaries about all the mysteries around Rennes le Château. BBC says yes. So they start doing a series of documentaries, and Henry Lincoln is presenting the information that he's found in this book, unaware that these are forged documents. And eventually he starts running out of information, so then he just starts adding more information on top of it, you know, and building more stories. And then Lincoln hooks up with two other guys, Bagent and Lee, who are talking about some mysteries in the church and all the things, and the three of them get together and they go on the lecture circuit, and they start coming up with these other things, and they start adding more and more layers on top of it. So the encrypted message that Lincoln thought he found in one of these forged documents was in let me see if I have it. Yeah, here's one of the documents. And it's difficult to see in the slide, but if you look very, very closely, certain of the letters are just slightly raised. So there's like an A over here, and there's a D over there. And you can pull out all those messages, and you get a message that says in French, A Dagobert du Roi, et à Sion, et ce trésor, et la mort, which means to King Dagobert II, and to Sion does this treasure belong, and it is death. So Sion, Prior of Sion, and there were other things in the messages that referred to this idea of this Priory of Sion. This was planted by Pierre Plantard, the guy who wanted to be king. So he was starting to plant the seed of Priory of Sion as a medieval organization in this book. Who's King Dagobert II? Well, he had been a real king, French king in the 7th century of the Merovingian line. Merovingians had died off very suddenly, and it was another mystery what happened to the treasures of the Merovingians. So Lincoln and Bajan and Lee are reading this, and they're on the lecture circuit, and they're making more stuff up as they go along, and they're thinking, okay, so Dagobert, he was a Merovingian, and then the Priory of Sion, and what do we know about them? And, well, where did the Merovingians start? Well, it was Merowig. And Merowig, 5th century king, very little is known about him. Very little information remains, except that possibly his mother had been impregnated by a sea serpent. You know, it was just a story that she'd been swimming and then she came back and she was pregnant. So of course, right. So Lincoln and Bajan and Lee are thinking, okay, well, so what does Priory of Sion have to do with the Merovingians? Obviously something, sorry, fishy. and they're thinking like, okay, well, what is this? Well, wait a minute, early Christians, they had a secret symbol, wasn't it? They had a symbol which was like a fish. So maybe, and they're in this hotel, there, maybe this means that because their symbol was a fish, and Merowig's mom, well, that must mean that Merowig is of the bloodline of Jesus Christ. That's what it must mean. And so they're like, oh, they figured it out. And so they start adding this to their lecture circuit, and they're going around, and then they start putting, okay, well, who would have Jesus hooked up with? Okay, well, Mary Magdalene, and okay, so then the Prior of Sion is protecting the idea of this bloodline. And they're writing these books, and they write the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Well, Pierre Plantard sees this. He's horrified. He's not a descendant of Jesus Christ. He's a descendant of kings. He wants to be king. He doesn't want to be a descendant of Jesus Christ. You know, this story had gotten away from him, you know, from his fraud, and, you know, he's not happy about it. So eventually Plantard was saying about what and his son, and the truth all came out eventually, as it always does. But meanwhile, they'd written this book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Dan Brown reads the book, decides that this would make a great novel, goes on, writes the Da Vinci Code. So chain of speech, 1956, Noel Corbeau, innkeeper, Rennes le Château, starts these rumors about a hidden treasure. 1967, Pierre Plantard and Gérard de Sède published Le Trésor Maudit about this treasure and start adding more information to it and tie it to their whole Priory of Sion thing. 1969, Henry Lincoln, the Doctor Who writer, he reads their book, creates his own book, starts adding his own layers on top of it. 1982, he and a bunch of others write the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, saying the Priory of Sion is a fact. And 2003, Dan Brown writes Da Vinci Code, saying Priory of Sion is a fact. But none of it. It was just story building upon story building upon story. So other legends to do with the Templars and the Mongols. Remember that big painting that I showed you from the Versailles and Crusades. Well, at the time of the Crusades, and the Mongols were moving into the area. And one of the Mongol generals was named Muley, M-U-L-A-Y is the way we would spell it, Muley. And there was a time when the Mongols were coming in and the Muslims were battling them, and the Mongols won and the Muslims retreated, and then the Mongols retreated because they needed to give their horses grazing room. And the area around Jerusalem, really no one was in charge of it for a few months. Well, the Europeans, and you got to remember, there's no email, no Twitter, none of this. The Europeans, they kind of heard something going on, and they're like, oh my God, Jerusalem's been captured. The Mongols have captured, our friends the Mongols have captured Jerusalem, and they're going to give it back to us. And so these urban legends are just spreading through Europe that Jerusalem has been recaptured. The Pope even declares a special parade, great rejoicing, Jerusalem is going to be returned to us. But none of this was true. But you can find medieval documents that say Jerusalem was captured, and the Mongol general Muley was part of this. So modern historians who aren't reading things with a critical eye will see these, oh, look, Jerusalem was captured. Muley was there, Muley, and they don't know. It must be Jacques de Molay. So Jacques de Molay captured Jerusalem in 1299. Well, the French, they think this is a fine idea, that historians have figured this out, that Jacques de Molay, Grand Master of the Knights Templar, captured Jerusalem in 1299. So the French king says, make a painting about it. So he commissions a painting. Jacques de Molay captures Jerusalem in 1299. Beautiful painting. Never happened. Never happened. But if you go to Versailles, you can see this big painting. I've written to them and I've said, you know, you got a painting about a battle that didn't happen. They go, yeah, we know.
It's a real painting.
It's a beautiful painting. Jacques de Molay was never there. All right. So, other stuff to do with the Templars. So the Templars, it captures the imagination. So again, the Templars were disbanded in the early 1300s. Other organizations, 1700s, started claiming Templar ritual. There continue to be Templar organizations starting this year. Every year we have people claiming to be Templars or claiming to have Templar things related. There's a Mexican drug cartel calling themselves the Knights Templar. So we have the Freemasons with the Templars. We have a United Nations approved charitable organization called the Sovereign Military Order of the Temple of Jerusalem. It was founded in 1804. Real organization. They call themselves Templars. Doesn't mean they're connected to the medieval Templars. And most recently, which it's just horrifying, but this nutcase in Norway that went out and massacred a bunch of people, and he's claiming to be a Templar. He's claiming that there's a group that was founded, it's called the PCCTS, but nothing to do with the medieval Templars. He's just choosing to call himself a Templar. And one of the things that really horrified me personally is this guy, Breivik, wrote a 1,500-page manifesto about the Templar, about what he was doing. And part of the manifesto has to do with the Templars. And part of that manifesto, he copied and pasted sections from the Wikipedia article about the Templars. And I wrote most of that article. So I'm looking at the manifesto and I'm seeing sentences that I wrote in this nutcase's manifesto, which is pretty damn creepy, let me tell you. I had nothing to do with it, okay? But, yeah, I was worried, should I even say that here at this talk? So if you want to read a real book about the Templars, accurate, well-researched historian. The gold standard is Malcolm Barber wrote a book called The New Knighthood and also Trial of the Templars. Peter Partner, who was before Barber, wrote a book called The Murdered Magicians, which has quite a bit of fact, but there's also some speculation. And Helen Nicholson is another modern scholar who's written The Knights Templar, A New History. Question?
Yes, great book about the Templar.
Steve Barry, yes. Yes, Steve Barry.
Yeah,
Steve Barry, I'm actually reading a book of his right now called The Jefferson Key.
Oh, Jefferson Key, okay, yeah. This is a friend of mine, because I also read James Rollins, are you familiar with him?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's like another one of those historic fiction authors, but I think like a good understanding, speaking of Freemasons, I've also been reading books related to them as well, so find it very interesting that you connected the two, because I feel like the Freemasons did take a lot of similarities from the Templars.
They definitely did.
As far as very strict, very polished, like we were talking about raising the flag, so I just think Steve Berry, Templar Legacy, is another good one if you were thinking.
Yeah, there's some wonderful fiction out there, Foucault's Pendulum. Definitely, the Freemasons, you know, they've got the different degrees of Freemasonry, 33rd degree, and as you're going through each degree, you're going through like a certain kind of a play, a skit that's being reenacted. I'm actually probably going to give a talk on Freemasonry next year. I keep threatening to give a talk about Freemasonry. And so Templar books not to read, okay? If you look at the back of the book and it says, this proves the connections between Templars and space aliens. Don't get it. Anything about the Templars reconquering Jerusalem in 1300 didn't happen. Anything about Templars in charge of the Mongol army. It's a flag to you that whoever wrote the book did not really do their research. Or if they did their research, they're just kind of accepting everything uncritically. They're not kind of checking the sources as to which are valid sources and which might have just been speculation at the time. So, real quick, I'm going to summarize and then we'll go to Q&A. Some other facts about Templars. When people say, oh, this person is a descendant of the Templars, I would repeat that Templars took a vow of chastity. They could not have contact with women. Therefore, they could not have descendants. Just putting that together there. unless space aliens can... I want to squash this. Some people said that the Templars were anti-Muslim, and they weren't. They had great respect for many of the Muslims. Some of them spoke Arabic, were friends. The Muslims had great respect for the Templars. It was sort of like military units on either side that have to fight in a battle, but they're really having great respect for the generals on either side. That was more the relationship. And anyone who says Templars were devil worshippers, no, these were trumped up charges by King Philip, who charged any of his enemies with devil worshipping. He charged the Pope with devil worshipping, just like he charged the Templars with devil worshipping. So Templars, reality, existed 1119 to 1312. They were sort of the world's first multinational corporation. They were arrested October 13th, 1307 in France. They had a massive impact on modern popular culture, and it's a very compelling legend. Lots of stories, each story building on the last. So just keep in mind what you're listening to and think about it critically. All right, any other questions? Yes, let's pass the microphone back there.
A couple of friends of mine like to put speculation, fact or fiction, in a line between the Knights Templar and Sweden, specifically the Swedish bank and the Swedish Royal Guard that now guards the papacy.
Yeah, you mean the Swiss, right?
The Swiss,
right.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I got this.
I'm with you.
But yeah, what do you know about any fact or fiction lines between the two?
It's a very intriguing idea. They're like, okay, the Templars have disappeared, and now there's this modern Swiss banking organization, and the Templars were the first multinational banking. I found nothing to verify that, though there's some intriguing stories, like a town in Switzerland that suddenly has advanced military tactics that is able to defend their town. I think it's more likely that it's just the Crusades were wonderful about disseminating ideas and science all across Europe. People were leaving their small towns in different countries and traveling to the Middle East. And anytime you travel, you're going to be picking up ideas and you're going to be bringing ideas back. That the idea that there were Templars who fled the Pope to Switzerland and set up an enclave there, it's possible, but I've never found any real proof about that. But it is one of the intriguing stories. Okay, who has the microphone now?
I've read that a lot of the Templars just weren't there when the French came around to arrest them. Was that just a case of the populace doesn't know nothing, or did they actually leave?
It's difficult to tell. Again, there's not a whole lot of information about some of these things, and there's some interesting stories, like maybe there was a Templar fleet that suddenly disappeared, seven ships with Templar gold. It's possible that the word got out. You know, local police that may have been told, oh, you have to arrest the Templars, may have said, hey, Jack, you know, don't be home tomorrow. But I haven't heard of anything large and organized in that way, but it's possible.
I've seen some researchers who have argued that the Templars, much like the Mandeans, held John the Baptist in particularly high esteem, even more so than Jesus Christ. Have you run across that as well, and do you have an opinion on that?
I've heard about the worship of a head, a relic that may have been the head of John the Baptist. And the Templars were definitely collecting relics, but anything about the Templars worshiping something else, you know, holding in higher esteem than Jesus Christ, I think that just comes from the trumped-up charges from the Inquisition.
It will fail. Trust me.
She has an aura around her. She's pushing the microphone away, so I will repeat her question. Okay.
In the case of the Knights Templar, were some of them able to be fathers before they joined the order?
Okay, good question. In the case of the Knights Templar, were some of them able to become fathers before they joined the order? And the answer is yes. There were some Templars who didn't just join as bachelors. They had already had families at the time, and then they joined the Templars. So yes, there could have been some children in that way. Some Templars also did join, not a lifetime joining, but they kind of would join an order for a few years and then would go back into their non-Templar life after that. So there were some like that, yes. Any other one in the back?
Going back to the issue of banking and the fact they were the first international bank. Now, the Jews had been put in a position of banking and usury was one of the only ways they could make a living, because it was a sin against Catholic law. How come a religious order, be it military, in fact it was given exemption from taxes, how come it was allowed to do something that was considered so sinful?
How were they able to do this?
How come, if it doesn't quite make sense, if the Jews had been put into a position that they were put into a position where usury was one of the main occupations, right, that they were allowed to do, because it was considered a sin for Christians, how could a religious order could do that?
It's a good question, and I've actually heard some research about that, and that the way they were loaning money was not a specific loan. It was more like a trade of services, but I don't know enough about it to really say in detail. But you have a good question. I just don't have a very good answer for it. It's just something that I haven't done specific research on. Okay. Any other questions? What did Dan Brown say when I told him the priory was fake? At that time, he'd already written the book was already written. Though an interesting story from that is that Brown was actually sued for plagiarism by two of the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail. It was a trial in England. It was a long trial. He won the trial. However, a funny story is that the judge in the trial, Justice Peter Smith, when he wrote the trial ruling, in this trial ruling, he hit a code. And he did it sort of like here, where there were certain letters that were italicized in the trial ruling. When word of this got out, the legal system in London ground to a halt because everybody was trying to crack the code. And my phone was ringing off the hook. Have you cracked it? Have you cracked it? We put together a team. We did crack the code. We weren't the first to do it. The code came out to say, it was multiple layers of code, but it came out to a message, Jackie Fisher, who are you? Dreadnought. And which itself is kind of mysterious. And what it was is the judge, Justice Peter Smith, one of his hobbies was naval history. And the most famous admiral in British history, anybody? Nelson. All right. Who's the second most favorite? Or most famous? Yeah, silence. All right. Jackie Fisher. And so the judge was, you guys aren't the only one who don't know, the second most famous. And so the judge wanted to honor his idol, Admiral Jackie Fisher. And Admiral Jackie Fisher lived around 1900 or so and had been involved with the launching of the first large British battleships, the Dreadnoughts. And the first one had launched 100 years ago to the day of when the plagiarism trial took place. So this was the judge wanting to honor Jackie Fisher and the launch of the Dreadnought. So Jackie Fisher, who are you, Dreadnought? Just a fun story, another code. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all for coming. I hope you have a great con. And remember to think about this stuff. Think about it. Thank you.